Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Justin McConnell, a writer and director whose films include The Collapsed, Skull World, and Broken Mile. He's also a producer, editor, and cinematographer with dozens of genre credits, and his new film, Life Changer, an interesting, unsettling spin on the body-swapping thriller, opens in Toronto, Ottawa, and Calgary this Friday, December 28th, before it comes to VOD in North America on New Year's Day. Justin picked Christmas Evil, Louis Jackson's 1980 horror movie about a disturbed toy factory worker who sets out to enforce the spirit of the holiday season with extreme prejudice. Well, that's how the distributor sold it, anyway. In practice, Jackson's film is worlds away from a slasher movie. It's an unpredictable, actively disquieting study of a damaged soul, grounded in an emotionally complex performance by Brandon Maggart. Although, well, grounded might not be the right word. You'll see. This is someone else's movie.
Christmas Evil is one of my favorite Christmas horror films. Largely because, I mean, obviously, I'm a fan of the Silent Night, Deadly Nights to an extent, and Saint and Gremlins and, you know, all the classics. Yeah. Die Hard, even though it's not a Christmas horror, is, you know...
It's pretty bloody.
Yeah.
But, I watched it again a couple of weeks ago for Jeremy Lalonde's podcast.
Yeah, exactly, which I've also been on while back.
Yeah. The knee violence alone in Die Hard is actually, like, there's a slow motion shot of just people's legs being shredded. It's surprisingly violent.
Yeah, it's pretty violent. But Christmas Evil to me is a very strong psychological thriller where, very much like Life Changer, the lead character, the protagonist, while not the hero, is trying to do things that to their own psyche they believe is right, or they believe some sort of a twisted sense of the world. They believe they're putting good into the world even though they're causing a lot of damage. Mm. And Christmas Evil has that same tone and that same theme as Life Changer does. So I thought they kind of complemented each other. Both also take place around Christmas. Christmas Evil is very overtly Christmas. Yeah. The guy works in a toy factory. He's very disappointed with the output that he puts out every day. He's pissed off that his boss cuts corners and makes shitty toys for profit, and sees him as like the antithesis of everything that Christmas stands for. And the idea that even from youth, his entire worldview is perverted by, I guess, perversion is the best way to put it. He did not take it well when his father dressed up as Santa Claus and then showed up as Santa and really made him believe. And then on the same night, he saw... I remember Fangoria was the first magazine I ever saw anything about Christmas Evil in the 90s. And there was a photo from that opening scene with Santa Claus kind of like worshipping his mother's legs. Sure. And the caption was something like, "Yes, vagina, there is a Santa Claus," which I was probably a Michael Gingold caption. It feels like something he wrote, but I'm not going to put that in his mouth.
That is such a long way to go for that joke, but that is just amazing that someone saw that and thought of it.
Yeah. So,
I mean, for me, it's the expertise the film has in its script, in the way that it basically just inverts all it never directly parodies the Christmas stuff. It's just there, right? It's I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, but if you actually did see that, it would be traumatic.
A little traumatic. Yeah. Obviously, he seems to be a somewhat twisted person even as a kid. Like, there's probably something wrong there.
Yeah.
And then he takes that way too far when he gets older, when he makes himself a de facto Santa Claus for his neighborhood, to the point where he's spying on the children with binoculars from a building across the street, which is both creepy and kind of endearing at the same time, because he's got two books that he keeps in there. Yeah. If you read the specificity of the infractions are like kicked over a garbage can, little things that are like kids being kids, but that's a naughty thing for a kid to do. So he writes it in a book. He's got I forget the name of the kid, but the one child, he's got this long, long page. That's the one he doesn't actively try and kill kids. He's very, even when he kills adults, it's usually like he either gets cornered in that place where he's trying to get to. I even forget who the character is he's trying to get to up the steps in front of the church. But there's three people kind of making fun of him in the Christmas spirit. And he massacres like three people on the steps because he's blocked by this crowd and he's just backed into a corner. And most of the people he actually kills in the movie are very much people he believes are against the Christmas spirit. And even a naughty kid isn't really against the Christmas spirit. So I don't think he just wants to scare them into being good.
Yeah, he sees himself as a benevolent force,
mm-hmm.
And he is so clearly not.
No,
and again, that's like the simple disconnection, which is really a yawning abyss, mm-hmm. of being a moral arbiter and being Santa. Like, yeah. Santa, well, this came out too. I guess we need to set up the context.
1980,
yeah. Around the same time as Silent, mm-hmm. Night, Deadly Night, and of course, it's been
a couple years before. I think maybe 1 year before.
Is it really?
Yeah, it predated Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Maybe they came out on video around the same VHS.
Probably, came out theatrically before Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Right.
I think it was 1 year before.
And the idea of this playing theatrically alone, it's the description. I admit. I have confused it as well as everybody else has probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the longest time, I didn't see it until, I guess, the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray came out a couple of years ago.
Okay, that was pretty recently.
Yeah, yes. 2014, as far as I can tell. And I probably saw it a year after that, because I always thought it had simply been another label for Silent Night, Deadly Night. I never actually realized they were two separate movies.
And not only that, the title Christmas Evil, Louis Jackson, the director, he does not like that title at all. That was forced on him by the distributors. The actual title of the film is You Better Watch Out.
Yeah,
which is a way better title. He doesn't see Harry, the Brandon Maggart's character, as evil. So he's like, what's the evil in Christmas Evil? And he's like, well, it's obviously capitalism and commercialism. If you listen to the commentary he did with John Waters on that disc. Actually, on the Synapse disc from before that.
Oh.
Because Synapse put it out first,
right,
I think.
They didn't carry it over? The Waters
cover? I don't remember. I don't have the Vinegar Syndrome disc, so I've only got the Synapse DVD from years ago. Because I played it. I paid Louis Jackson $200 to play it theatrically in Toronto at the projection booth in, like, 2011 or 2012.
Nice.
And I'm sure the 9 people who showed up had a really good fucking time.
It does occupy a really weird space, though. Mm-hmm. It's not a slasher film. It has brutal violence in it, but it's not a slasher film. It's more like Taxi Driver than anything else.
That's what I was thinking. It's After Hours. It's a Dark Night on the Town film, like Stuart Gordon's Edmund, something like that, where it's a character on a downward spiral, or Bone. The Larry Cohen film, the husband's story in Bone, where he like goes out in the town and he's kind of nuts and he just gets further and further down this sort of rabbit hole of, but in this case, this character actually is psychotic to some degree. Like,
I mean, he's killing people.
He's killing people.
He's clearly disturbed. Mm-hmm. He's, as you said, he's operating along a rationale that we understand it, but we can't necessarily agree with it or see where it's going. But his rules are very simple, so in that way, it does kind of play like a slasher film.
A little bit.
You know, like you go in the woods, you have sex, you curse, Jason will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
This guy has a very similar moral code.
I think it's more complicated, though, than something in Silent Night, Deadly Night, though, where a similar approach of he's like the Avenger for Christmas, and he's also on a bit of an actual revenge bent against the convent or wherever he grew up, but that is very much like that's a true slasher movie. That's like teens or you know young people partying and
just
getting in the
dispatched,
like, being dispatched, and you don't get that deep into Ricky. You don't get that deep into Ricky's character. In this one, you've got long takes where Brandon Maggart, who's actually exceptional in the film, he's really good.
And I knew him primarily from
Dressed to Kill.
Brothers, weirdly enough, a cable show that no one remembers. It was, I want to say, it might have been HBO, it might have been Showtime. It was a U.S. cable show that ran here on First Choice or Super Channel or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was a half-hour multi-camera sitcom about 3 adult brothers, one of whom was just coming out. The youngest of the three has come out as gay, and the other two brothers are handling it very... They think they're handling it very well, but they're really handling it very badly. And it was screamingly stereotypical, but also surprisingly well. It was Will and Grace before Will and Grace.
And this was how long ago? Like the 80s?
Mid-80s.
Wow.
I mean,
I'm surprised that sitcom even existed.
Yeah, like, it was one of the
first... Even if it was short-lived.
I think 3 seasons.
Wow.
It was one of the first shows to mention AIDS.
Huh.
And it did it in an absolutely terrible, just clumsy fashion now, in a very special episode kind of way.
Yeah, but at least they were trying, before. You know?
Maggart was the blue-collar character. Mm. He was like the tough brother who was okay with calling people fruit. Was like, it wasn't exactly comic relief. But I remember thinking, coming away from that show, that he was the most interesting actor in all of it because he showed you the
content.
And
it's strange, he hasn't done much else besides a bunch of TV appearances. Like, he was in Dressed to Kill, he had an okay-sized role there. Then he did Christmas Evil as a lead, and then after that, he just sort of like, he was a very reliable character actor who would show up from time to time. But yeah. Christmas Evil is also full of those actors. Mark Margolis pops up.
Jeffrey DeMunn, yeah.
Jeffrey DeMunn, Raymond J. Barry. They all pop up in these tiny little roles, but I think that adds a lot of texture to the world. And you know, it feels believable, even though it's sort of heightened. But I think the heightened elements are all in Harry's head.
Yeah, anyway, it's definitely a subjective film in its depiction. And we see when we, well, in the ending alone, but it, except someone else sees it.
Yeah.
We'll get there. But it is one of those films where watching it for the first time, what, 30-odd years later, at least, I just kept thinking, oh, this is, first of all, it's not what I thought it was at all. And second, it's really distinctive. Like, this is the only movie
stylistically made, distinctive. Right? If you read Lewis's intro in the Synapse DVD and some of his commentary, I forget the name of the artist, but he had his production designer design the entire film based on a specific Christmas painter. Mm-hmm. Like, so the entire film had the look of this magical kind of overcolored, very stylized Christmas approach where every frame has this sort of idea. And it's not Norman Rockwell, but it's that style of painting. He made a horror movie based on an art style like that, which is just blows my mind.
Yeah, it's the kind of movie that makes you, first of all, it made me wonder why he didn't make anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
And also I think that how was frustration. He ever made one.
Yeah, because, exactly.
You know, like it's a film that's unaware of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so creates its own. And having just done an episode with Peter Kaplowski about Don't Let the River Beast Get You, I'm in this zone of like outsider horror.
And this is very much an early piece of outsider art. And, and I like how there are, at times it's very high paced when, you know, when he's being chased by the people with torches and things like that. But otherwise the camera will linger on him as he's looking in a locker mirror and trying to force the smile on his face and get that, like, cause he's a very dour character and he's very depressive and he's not a particularly happy person, but he's able to be jovial when he puts himself in the Santa persona. But they actually show him in one long take try and force that persona on himself. Mm-hmm. And there's other parts where he goes to the children's hospital. You know, again, he's trying to do good. He steals a ton of toys from the factory. He brings it to a children's hospital, has them donated, and as they go inside to get help to bring the toys out, he's outside trying to practice Merry Christmas until it, like, louder and louder and louder and louder. It's like he has to, he believes he's the persona, but he has to force it out of him because he can't just turn it on. I think my favorite scene in the movie is he glues the beard on himself for the first time and he's looking in the mirror. It's another one of those long shots. And he just starts tugging at the beard and it's such a, I can tell why John Waters likes the film so much because it's almost like, I'm not saying channeling divine, but channeling that kind of outsider actor.
It's in conversation with all the camp stuff, but it's not camp at all. It's the thing that, it's the thing in your brain that you tug on when you watch a movie that doesn't answer its own questions. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, like he's obviously the pulling on the beard is his own childhood connection. And Maggart is such an interesting actor. It's all in his eyes. It's all in his shoulders. You see this tension that he's fighting with.
There's a part of the Christmas party where someone taps him on the shoulder and he actually physically shivers for half a second. And you'll blink and you'll miss it, but he shivers and then he calms himself down and he has a conversation.
Yeah.
But the conversation is fucking insane.
Yeah.
Because he's talking about, it's throughout the movie, he's talking about, he's finally understands the music you're all playing and he can now dance to it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that means that, like, he kind of gets the way of the world, at least the way his mind works, and he's figured out how he's going to push his way through it, which he's already over the deep end at that point.
Yeah. But he's proud of the fact that he thinks he knows how to be a person.
Yeah.
Like that's his revelation. His breakthrough is that he's never felt normal. And now he kind of does.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, it's almost like the identity narrative of this thing is fascinating for
him. Well, I think it takes an outsider to write something like that. And I think a lot of the darker places you mentioned, me going a life changer was the same sort of idea. It was just me mining the weirder parts of myself to try and put that on screen in a psychotic way. I could see Lewis Jackson doing the same thing while writing Christmas Evil. Like, and part of the reason some people maybe don't continue to work or they don't continue to make things is they are so singular with that, with their vision, that it scares me. Richard Stanley's another artist that's very similar where he's, you know, having met the man and spent time with him, he's fascinating. And he could lecture you on, like, any historical topic you want to talk about, he's researched it, and he's a very, very nice person. I think it just scares people because he's so, I'm guessing, I mean, I don't know Lewis, I've only talked to him briefly, but I'm guessing that kind of an artist, they can probably have a habit of scaring away money, people who like things to be very cut and dry and very just like, okay, tell me what it is, tell me how to sell it, And, you know, how does it hit these quadrants and how does it hit this audience? I don't care about the art. I don't care. Or, you know, I do, but I don't. That sort of thing could really scare people in both directions. Like, okay, well, I don't want to work for these people. And, okay, well, I don't want to work with you because you're not going to play nice and be easy.
Yeah, it's a weird place to be right now in terms of genre where everybody responds to a singular vision once it's finished and completed right in front of them, right? Yeah. Like, the struggle to get that vision onto the screen is exhausting and arduous and disheartening, and people get turned away and give up.
And exhaustion. There are lots of creators that have sort of fallen on the sort of the business wanting them to just focus on making something that does business, and them wanting to. I know plenty of friends with some of the best scripts I've ever read that, and I'm not going to name anybody. Peter and I have mutual that they're incredible stories, and you know, we're trying to get, you know, Peter's trying to get this one made. And I hope it gets made, because once it's done, people will call it brilliant, and that people will fucking love it. And I'm sure I can swear. I can swear. People will love it, but I couldn't imagine sitting in a room and pitching this project to somebody and having them go, okay, I get that. You know, like, it's very much like you get it once you've read it and somebody's talked to you about it in detail. But, you know, you got 10 minutes with an investor and you go, well, it's about blah, 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 blah. And they go, what?
How do you do this in the room anymore? How do you figure out? I mean, this is easy. Guy in a Santa suit goes crazy. Yeah, you can say it in a sentence. What it is radically different, but at least it's a pitch we sort of understand. And I understand why the distributors sort of betrayed it that way with the poster that they went with and with the title.
Which is also why it's been unfairly, not forgotten, because it's been resurrected on a cult level because of the people who understand the film, the synapses, the vinegar syndromes. They get outsider art, and they're going to put all the effort they can in putting out a good release, and the like-minded people will buy those releases. It's pay a lot of money for them because they can't run a lot of units. But
it's amazing, though, that has become a thing now, that we're at a place where, in distribution, where a viable market model is 5,000 Blu-rays.
I bought Ice Cream Man for $45.
The Caruso.
No, Ice Cream Man, the Clint Howard film.
Oh, talking Ice Cream Cone. Head Man?
Yeah. So I bought that. I spent $45 on the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray of that, and I do not regret it.
Yeah, I don't want to tell you how much I paid for the first Steelbook of Suspiria.
Yeah. I paid $80 for that. Yeah. I actually bought 5 of them because I was going to I thought it was going to go the way the Phantasm box sets went, and I could resell them for. I ended up reselling them at cost value, but I bought 5 of them, thinking if I sit on this for 6 months, maybe
speculation.
I
can. But
people fucking got pissed off at me at that. It's like, well, you're taking it away from other. No, they're still out there. There's a reason that they didn't go up in value.
They weren't that hard to find.
Yeah. I did spend $80 on that. I think I spent $85 importing the limited edition Combat Shock Blu-ray that was just released.
Right.
Like, part of that's just respect to Buddy, because he's, you know, I drank with him and he's a really nice guy. But part of it is I really like the film. But again, very singular, outsider art kind of film. And I
still can't believe Troma got behind that one. I remember that back in the day when the VHS tapes came out, and I was like, we're doing this and it's not what you think it is. It's like, no, goddamn, you're right.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a Troma film, but I have to appreciate when a company takes a risk on that.
Yeah, like, and another weird overheated Troma did
Christmas
study.
Evil as well. That's how Christmas Evil was in the public consciousness.
Yeah, right. That's Troma's where the original they still have the supplements from that.
Yeah, they do. Yep.
Yeah. Which, again, I don't fully understand how those visions lined up, but this weird mutual thing.
I think it's film fans. It's fans of film who see something unique and go, you know, nobody else is going to give this a home, so why not us? It's the same sort of thing. I do acquisitions with IndieCan, and I've been actively trying to find retrospective titles that, you know, just don't have I've been trying to find Source Riverbend, which is like Sam Furstenberg's film with Steve James from 1989 that Canon Films did, which I think in this political climate would have a great new life. Pins, another one which needs a new release. And there's these sort of films that they're not lost to time. The Borrower, John McNaughton's film, The Borrower, which, you know, there's similarities between The Borrower and Life Changer, but I've loved that film for quite a while. And, it's a lost film.
I think I reviewed it when the videotape.
Yeah, well, it's because Canon Films released it on video, but that was as Canon was dying.
Right. And what happened Warner doesn't still own those?
Well, Warner owns it now. So Canon split up between Warner and MGM. Warner owns it. The problem is that Warner's got an archive. I can't go into too much detail, but the Warner archive stays closed for the most part. And just recently, Scream Factory was able to get a block of Warner titles. They weren't able to get that one yet. So I've been trying to find it at home at Anchor Bay initially, and now I'm trying with Scream Factory. Just because I think it's a film that a new whole generation would probably enjoy, even though it's so weird.
If nothing else, now the practical effects alone connect to people
for sure. But it's a weird, unique movie, and especially as a follow up to Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, it was like what? But it deserves. I think it deserves its place in the sun more so than it had. And I think that's all that happens is that somebody who is passionate about a film goes, you know, I've got. I think that's the whole reason companies like Severin exist, right? Is David Gregory probably went, look at all these films that nobody is seeing. Let me scoop them up and we'll put them out. And I think it's a testament to the idea that film means something. And especially to people who are you know, cinephiles, they want to see the films they grew up loving and that they grew up appreciating and finding connection to live on. And they may have to go into debt to do that.
it's the labor of love thing. Yeah. The aspect of it is, I used to say, I suppose I still say, every movie ever made is somebody's favorite movie. Now, mm-hmm. It may be the filmmaker in some cases, but the way that people bond to stuff, the way that people are willing to do whatever it takes to share a given film that they love with other people, I think that's the thing that pushes me into this. More than anything else, like that's what the show is about. Mm-hmm. The idea that it's meaningful because it means something to someone, and then that person gets to explain why, to understand, to help other people, to bring them to
exactly.
To
and I theme. Honestly think there's an audience for almost anything, and whether that's a good or a bad thing is up for interpretation. But the reality of it is that I mean, I'll just even get personal here for half a second. Right. I mean, you haven't liked a lot of the stuff I've done in the past. That doesn't mean there isn't an audience for it.
Oh, sure.
And it's the same sort of idea with almost anything that gets made. You're going to find an acolyte who actually really believes, okay, no, this hit me at the right time of life, and I know there's other people out there like it. Let's try and bring it exposure again. There are films that get lost because they kind of just never found those people to support it. Mm. Absolutely. But I think that if anything that's made with enough passion and enough of a singular vision and enough kind of something that doesn't feel like it was made by committee or cheap or like just like another thing to pump into the market as a product, anything that has that sort of personal identity to it. You were talking to Peter about Don't Let the River Beast Take You.
It's exactly
the same following that movie has now. Yeah. Just from, you know, I'm going to go see tomorrow night. I'm going to go see Deadly Games or 3615 Code Père Noël. Dial Code Santa Claus. You know, it's got so many different titles. The fact that that's coming back now after like being lost for so long.
Have you seen it before?
Yeah, I saw it at the first Laser Blast screening the first time.
I only caught up to it a couple of weeks ago, and oh boy.
Yeah, but the fact that this movie might have been lost to time if there weren't passionate people like Laser Blast people were some of the first to sort of bring it back, but before that.
It was the Alamo, right? They were...
Yeah, the Alamo did, AGFA, they're bringing it back through the prints right now, but even way earlier than that, the guy who runs the Duke Mitchell Film Club and one of the lead programmers at Fantastic Fest, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name.
Oh, no worries. I forget names all the time.
It's Dunbar's number. It's a statistical analysis that says you've only got room for 160 names or faces at any given time. And
I believe it.
In any case, I
would probably go with half that myself.
Yeah. In any case, he played it at the Duke Mitchell Film Club years before Laser Blast did. Okay. But again, this is all sort of like in underground circles. It's slowly gained a cult following, and now it's getting a pretty good release, and it's the talk of the Christmas season.
Yeah,
which is great. But that's a slow bullet.
And it's the love of the civilians, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's people who didn't make the film, people who discovered it and found it. The same way Christmas Evil has been bubbling along, to suddenly become. I don't know that it's suddenly relevant again, but it felt like a very modern... I mean, it's messy and it's cheap and it mm-hmm. cuts a lot of corners in terms of present-day aesthetics, but there's something... Like, seeing it the same year as First Reformed is kind of weird. There's a continuity, there's a commonality mm-hmm. in these movies about people struggling with clinical depression or whatever psychosis it is.
And then trying to make the world better in their own perspective or their own mindset, worldview, whatever it happens to be.
It feels organic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like it comes from the same basic place.
It might come from the same idea of just being frustrated with like, if it, the stuff I've heard in Lewis's commentary and I've read in his liner notes and all mm-hmm. that sort of thing, he very much seems like It very much seems like Harry is like a psychotic personification of his own view of Christmas, or his own view of the commercialism of what was once a pure holiday. And I can't, I'm never mean to put words in somebody else's mouth. This is all just, you know, an analysis of what I can extrapolate from that.
Sure.
But I will say that I appreciate that worldview. And I think in my own work, there's a definite sense of being tired by how the world goes eventually, how the direction the world takes, or how it leaves behind the values or the things you might have held dear in your past, sometimes for the better, maybe a lot of times for the better, but also sometimes, you know, just because there is time moves forward and something is improved or upgraded, or you know, a tradition or a holiday changes into something else. You know, Christmas, which was always has been a commercial. I mean, obviously it was religious for, it's still religious for a long time, but it, at a certain point it became a very commercial holiday.
Yeah. Well, certainly in Western culture.
Yeah, in Western culture.
Yeah, it's always represented that.
But there was still, it felt like there was this weird purity to it for a long time of just like, yeah, you give your kids some toys and you all get together as a family, and you, it maybe it's a skewed perception of an idealized thing that was never really true, but at least that's the way it was painted through maybe through the 50s through to the 80s or something. And then it turned into Saturday morning cartoon violence toy hour. And you just had to like go through the Sears catalog or go, you know, buy everything you could. And it was an arms race to buy the best gift for your kids to beat all the other parents out. And it was just, but again, this is,
which is now the plot of a beloved Christmas classic, Jingle All the Way.
Yeah, right? Of course. Like that's, which again has grown from, people kind of liked it when it came out to, yeah, this movie's amazing.
Yeah, but they're, again, they were raised on it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think what you're saying, like, it seems to move generationally. Mm-hmm. Like the idea that Christmas was advertising in the 80s, which has now been embraced by the kids of the night who grew up in the 90s and don't really remember what it was like then, it's now their warm blanket.
Well, the 20-year cycle of nostalgia, right? Is that the people in the 80s were nostalgic for the 60s, and the people in the 2000s to 2010s are nostalgic for the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And I have no idea if the people in the 2030s or 2040s are going to be nostalgic for the early 2000s, but
I can't.
Who knows?
I just assume it'll be like a more Locke and Eloy situation where everything will be destroyed by that point.
Yeah, maybe.
It doesn't really matter. Will it be nostalgic for
it could be also that oversaturation sort of leads to an idea, like, an idea that maybe claiming an era for your own, like the 2000s or 2010s, maybe there won't be that much attachment for somebody later down the line because there's just too much choice, and the internet's blown it all out.
I wonder what will emerge, right? Like, is Stranger Things going to be a nostalgic point 20 years down the road?
No, because it's already a nostalgic point. Like, it's like, what, if you're nostalgic for Stranger Things in 20 years, then, you know, you never experienced the thing 40 years ago. Right. So it's
that's what I mean. If everything now is built on the older stuff, what will the new old stuff be in 20 years?
I think we can't predict it. I think there are films and pieces of media that have grown in popularity over the years that you could have never predicted would be what they are now. And I just look at John Carpenter's The Thing, which when it came out was critically derided, spectacularly bombed, and you know, every review was awful, and disillusioned Carpenter to the point where he didn't want to do a lot of other studio stuff. He did, but he got very bitter about it all. I love him as a director. I he's one of my favorites. But that being said, like, you look at it now and it's the watershed moment for practical effects. It's considered to be a horror classic. You know, there are a whole generation of people grew up watching it. Critics be damned. And I think you can't predict what the next thing is going to be in 20 years. And that's why as a creator, I don't think you can kowtow to a trend or follow something that you hope will live on. You just have to create what means something to you, and eventually down the line, maybe it'll live on and it'll have some special place on someone's heart. I mean, if all I ever do down the line is some kid like me has a section of their video shelf with my movies on it, I've done what I set out to do on this earth. It's weird that that's the goal, but
I totally get that. The idea of leaving a legacy on your own terms, mm-hmm. right?
And something singular like Christmas Evil, removed from the protests of Silent Night, Deadly Night, and probably how much that would have buried its home video release, and just the idea that it was released almost like as an also-ran to Silent Night, Deadly Night, because that one got all the press and all the scorn and all the, you know, all the big marketing, and Christmas Evil kind of was quietly dropped for a little while. The fact that now, you know, you can easily go on Shudder and watch it anywhere pretty much in the world that Shudder is. There's a readily available Blu-ray and DVD, and it is talked about now as in this cult Christmas classic.
Yeah.
Probably more, and respected probably more so than Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, the Silent Night, Deadly Night movies, none of them is any good. Not
technically. And I think out of the five, the only one I can rewatch and get enjoyment out of as like, okay, I'll watch this again next Christmas is Part 5. The Brian Yuzna one.
Oh, the Initiation, is that it?
No, the Toymaker.
The
one with the crazy Mickey Rooney role. Mickey Rooney's actually a robot. He made a Pinocchio-like plastic sun. It's got all the weird screaming mad George effects and the killer toys. And
but wasn't the Yuzna
did four as well.
Right, he did four.
But four is
the bugs and
tougher. It's not much of a Christmas movie.
No, it is a weird ass movie.
Yeah, it's weird. I really appreciate Yuzna again for that singular vision because
right. That's the one where Clint Howard is Ricky.
Okay. Yeah. Or he's like a I don't know if he's Ricky in it. Is he Ricky or is he just like a servant to the cult, to the witches, to the cult? Like,
I thought both, but I could be wrong. It's been at least 20 years since I saw
it. I just watched it last year, but I don't really remember. But Toymaker still sticks with me, just because it's one of those things. The VHS art was really like, well, I got to see that movie. Yeah. And then I watched it, and I think out of all five of them, obviously Part 2's got Garbage Day and all that you know, the Garbage Day scene everyone loves. It's a great 10 seconds. And and the first one is out of all of them probably the best made, but it's not like it's the best slasher film out there.
No, I hate saying it that a horror movie can be too sadistic, but I think that the Silent Nights, the first two really are just sort of,
well, they're murder for murder's sake in a lot of ways.
They're not, they don't have the grace of a Halloween. I mean, nothing has the grace of a Halloween, but even the sort of weird, no bullshit authenticity of the Friday the 13th movies isn't there. It's just, it feels like exploitation of exploitation.
Yeah, I could see that. It definitely feels like somebody picking a holiday by throwing a dart and then going, okay, well, we'll put him in a Santa suit.
Yeah, this will get people talking.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why out of all five of those, Part 5 is the only one that feels like a Christmas movie. It feels like something I want to revisit just because it's so bonkers out there.
Yeah.
But
Christmas Evil has a reason for everything.
Yes.
It is rooted in the season. It's about disillusionment with the holiday. Like it builds its own cultural moment, if that makes any sense.
I think so. And it very much stands alone. I actually watched a YouTube video last week from a creator I respect who just watched the first five Silent Night, Deadly Night films for the first time, and then talked about how there was Christmas Evil that came out the year before, but it's kind of the same film. It's not as good. And I went, I don't know if I can respect that vision, dismissing it in one sentence like that when there is so much more going on below the hood of this film.
Do you think he'd seen it or just looked at the
poster? I feel like he just looked at the poster or something. That's such a dismissive... there are people that I would have figured have seen it by now who I tell, you should probably give this a watch if you haven't seen it, because I keep trying to convince people and it's just so hard to.
Yeah. My experience of it was I thought I had seen it because I thought it was just a...
Well, one you could dismiss easily, like Don't Open Till Christmas, the one with the slaughtering of the Santas.
Right,
I could see absolutely, it did get lumped in with all that stuff. But it stands on its own entirely, and it's largely because of Brandon Maggart and just the weird worldview the film has, and it's very much it's a singular protagonist driven film. There aren't really any scenes outside of a couple of scenes with the cops investigating afterwards that are outside of the perspective.
Although it does
give
Harry that lineup, which is so great.
Yeah.
The lineup of Santas who are all taking the job way too seriously.
Yeah.
Like, I have toys to make. I got to get back to the workshop.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a moment where the whole world seems as crazy as the lead character, and it's wonderful.
Even the way the cops are talking to each other, they're just like making jokes about the Christmas season or in and around the murder investigations.
Yeah.
Like, I really like, there aren't that many kills in the movie. The small massacre at the steps of the church,
right.
And there's
the
where
he
murders his boss or the toy company owner in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
But
which
one
is
thing
really
I
weird and intimate and unpleasant.
It's incredibly unpleasant. It's a lot like a scene we've got in an upcoming film called Mark of Cain. That's from a book that was written in 1990. But the point is that the idea that he walks into this bedroom, the wife's still asleep. The way it's edited, where he's trying to smother him with the bag of toys, but he's looking over at the wife and making sure she's not asleep, and there's this... It's so cleverly edited because you're in Harry's mind in that moment, And he's looking around the room for another weapon he could potentially use if he wakes up, if she wakes up. Yeah. Like,
you're worried. Every for him. Cut. It's really strangely sympathetic.
Yeah, every cut, it informs what. It's not just, okay, he walks into the stabs and it's over. It's played out more like when a character in a noir film has to dispose of a body and someone knocks on the door and, like, it's that kind of... It's
more problems to solve over and over again.
Exactly. And then the wife wakes up and as the throat is being slashed and she can't scream at all. She's just trying to get the scream out and he walks out, he sees the kids, he smiles at them, they smile back, he's Santa Claus, and then the scream comes. That whole sequence is just so well executed.
Yeah, and jarring because up until that point, we've seen him be violent, but we haven't seen him be...
Like premeditated.
Yeah, and conflicted about it
too. Yeah, exactly.
Sort of caught in the middle of what to do and how to do it and realizing that he's not good at it is actually another way of keeping us on his side even as he's doing all this.
Well, you could see it in his face too that there's regret there.
Yeah.
Like he is not a cut and dried crazy person. I mean, he is. He's lost, and I'm not going to get into clinical terms.
No, but for the purposes of the film.
Yeah, for the purposes of the film, he's insane. But there's a war going on, and you can see it in his eyes and in his facial expressions, and just the performance leads to this idea that he thought what he was doing was right, and then afterwards he's like, oh, shit, maybe not. And
it's that weird thing that you recognize in outsized fantasy film where we have to still kind of be people in the middle of this bizarre, insane thing. There is no explaining the ending.
No, I rationalize that as it's a death dream for him, but someone else does see, or it looks like they see.
Yeah.
But and they're reacting with wonder, but are they just reacting to the car going into the river?
Yeah.
Like I don't. It's nicely left up for interpretation, and I'm entirely on board with that. I don't think it says he's actually Santa Claus, as I've heard other people say.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is an interesting idea, but I guess
the origin story.
Yeah, the origin or the idea that somehow through his pure Christmas spirit, he's become Santa or something like that. Right. I do think it's a death dream, but I can't honestly say that that's absolutely what it is.
Yeah.
I don't even know if Lewis Jackson would know what it is if you truly asked him. Like, would he know what the ending means? Or I don't know.
I would hope he wants it to be
a
true victory.
It
feels like the movie gets you there. It feels like the movie makes it possible for it to be happening either way, for it to be real or fantastic or a fantasy, just because at that point it has done so many things that movies aren't supposed to do, and it has taken so many different approaches to things that it's like literally anything could happen.
Well, the tensest scene in the movie is the party after he kills the people at the foot of the steps, the massacre. He's looking in on a Christmas party where there's kids sleeping on the one side and the parents are all dancing, and he's sort of swaying along with the Christmas music, and then drunken Mark Margolis and his friend are outside. He's like, we caught you, you're coming inside, and they force him to be Santa in front for the whole party and for the kids. He's just killed three people, and the tension there is like, especially when he makes the speech, when he's like, if you're good boys and girls, you know, I'll bring you lovely presents every year, but if you're bad, I'll bring you something horrible. And there's this silence.
Yeah.
And then he just laughs as loud as possible, and everyone sort of like loosens up a little bit, but no matter what, the parents are still giving this look. It's like, I imagine directing that scene, like, as singular the vision of the film is, it doesn't feel random to me at all. It feels very intentional. Like, he told the parents, okay, this is the look you need to have. He knew exactly. Maybe he was a school of, or from the school of De Palma. Maybe I don't know his background as a film lover.
Yeah. I almost wonder if he told them anything at all and just let it happen. And
it's possible because it was shot in a lot of wides. So it's possible.
And it feels real.
Yeah.
It feels really or like alive in a way that it probably shouldn't for a movie like this.
Yeah.
Where you suddenly have this intrusion of discomfort and where people are.
It is shot in two fairly wide shots, so it's entirely possible.
And he just covered it and
that he just covered it and let it happen. That's possible.
I mean, I kind of want it to be that way.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Is it's entirely like you'd have to be there, you know, or there would have had to been. Maybe it's in the commentary and I missed it where they explain that. I'll have to go back.
But that's like. Yeah, that's absolutely why John Waters loves it.
Yeah,
like it's his sense of the strange and unusual having that triumphant moment over the normals, mm-hmm. over the straights, where just suddenly they are uncomfortable in the majority.
Yep.
Something else is going on they can't control. That's his thing. Like, mm-hmm. I wish I'd been there when he saw it for the first time. I would love to know how he responded to it.
Yeah, what he thought coming out of the cinema, you know, did he have to go sit with friends and drink and, like, really unpack that, or was he alone? Like, I would, like, maybe that's in the... Maybe there, it's out there. Maybe there's some kind of he's done a write-up or something like that.
But the origin story.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely not your typical Christmas horror film. And the fact that it's, you know, one of John Waters' favorite Christmas horror films, and that so many cult indie proponents trump it up is what it is. I would say if you haven't seen it, you absolutely need to track it down, and it is not hard to find thanks to Shudder. Yeah. And you can, you know, Shudder's $5 a month, and right now you can probably do a free trial. So it's like, you know, sign up and delete the, cancel after you watch it if you want to.
Nah, they'll keep it.
But keeping it's a good idea.
It's worth it.
Oh yeah, Shudder's a great platform. Yeah.
And the best thing I can say about it now is that after we've been talking about it for however long. If you're listening and you haven't seen it, you still don't understand it.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely experience.
No, it's very much an experiential movie, and I do remember the first time watching it, because I expected exactly what you did, that it was just going to be this Santa slasher kind of film.
Yeah.
I had somewhat of an inkling because of my subscription to Fangoria, and I'd read an article about it in the 90s. I didn't remember much of the article. I remember the caption, because it was stupidly funny.
Oh, I would never forget that.
Yeah, and I remembered them. I don't remember who wrote the article. I feel it was a Gingold article. But just talking about its cult legacy and things like that, this was even in the 90s. But beyond that, I hadn't seen it until probably early 2000s. I think I rented it from Suspect Video in the early 2000s. That's the first time I saw it. And I remember sitting and watching it, and I just was entranced. It was one of those films that I realized, okay, this stands as something very unique, and to dismiss it easily is a mistake. And more people need to see this. And hopefully, over time, people will warm up to it even more.
Yeah, well, that's what we're here for. Literally, yeah. Like, this is what the show is for. Mm-hmm. To pull people in. And so then to get people out on the episode, you've already sort of touched on it a little bit, but is there anything of Christmas Evil that you've used or borrowed or incorporated into your own creative DNA, into your own work?
I mean, nothing particularly specific, except the idea that through... a lifetime of watching film, there's probably any film that has affected me in any way is woven into the DNA of any work I do, because on a subconscious level, those wheels are turning and I don't really know where particular ideas are coming from. It's only afterwards on reflection I can go back and go, yeah, that's a little like that. Or yes, there's definitely some sort of a tonal or thematic connection there. But if I say that Christmas Evil has a thematic connection to Life Changer, I can probably name 10 other films that do as well, or 20 sure, other yeah. films that do as well. So it's hard to pinpoint it as, yes, this influenced it. But it definitely, just in my self-education in film, my obsession with cinema, in growing up and watching what I do and collecting the films I do and, you know, watching... and absorbing whatever I can, absolutely, I think there's influence there. But whether or not, I mean, it's definitely not direct. But I can give credit where credit is due and say that it is one of the films, of many films, that have helped sort of formulate my perception of what film can be.
Sure. Well, I mean, yeah. It's not just why you choose a film for the podcast, but how you come to choose it in the first place. And I always find that there's some little thing being tugged.
Yeah.
Not almost always.
Well, I definitely thought of it having a thematic connection, and also because both films take place over Christmas, it definitely had a... Because I wanted to do a Christmas film, because this is supposed to be releasing Christmas Day or the day before or something like that, I wanted something Christmas-related. My first choice was Love and Peace, which I highly recommend you find regardless. It's probably one of the best Christmas films made in the last 10 years, even though when you first watch it, you may not see why it's a Christmas film for the first maybe hour of it. I'm not saying anything more. I think it's heartwarming, and I think kids can watch it. They might have trouble reading the subtitles.
Right. This is Sion Sono's...
Sion Sono's Love and Peace. It's a break from his regular films in that it isn't crazy and violent. It's heartwarming and funny and bizarre. It's still bizarre, but it's...
Yeah. I think the only film he's made that isn't bizarre in some way is the Fukushima movie.
Yeah.
The Land of Hope, which...
But, of course, you want to be respectful when you're doing a Fukushima movie.
Yeah. It's amazing how a somber... reality-based drama is his outlier.
Yeah. As opposed to everything else. Well, that's Miki too. His like Shield of Straw and stuff like that is an outlier for Miki. And it's I think a lot of those cult Japanese the directors that break out into the Western market are known for their crazy stuff, and when they aren't making films that are their crazy ones, they don't get seen as much, which is a shame. Like Love and Peace, we tried at IndieCan to acquire it for Canada at least, and the asking price was just too high. It's I think it's Nakatsu, so it's a larger company. It still doesn't have a release here, so we couldn't do it for the podcast. But I love that film as a Christmas film. In this case, I really love Christmas Evil, both as a Christmas horror film, but also as something that deserves more exposure and does have at least some degree of thematic connection to Life Changer, to the point where it made sense to come on the podcast and do it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. And Life Changer is in theaters.
It's in theaters December 28th in Toronto, Calgary, and Ottawa. And then it hits VOD across North America on January 1st. And comes out in the UK a month later, and there will be discs, but we can't talk about the release date yet.
Nice. Well, I mean, I love the fact that a movie about people who are a character that reinvents itself repeatedly is coming out on New Year's Day.
Yeah.
Somehow there's
something, interesting about that. Hopefully people are, you know, not too hungover and actually want to rent it that day, but you can't... films live on long past their release date now. Sure. So if it takes, I mean, it's being pretty well appreciated now, but if it takes a decade for people to really glom onto it, or if it never happens, whatever. But I can't look at things like over the next month, I have to deal with, you know, Life Changer's life is going to be longer than that. And yeah, it's one of those things that eventually watch it, hopefully, and either like it or don't, but give it a chance. And I hope people enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who knows how long this podcast will be floating around out there.
Yeah, it's impossible to tell. The internet is forever. Yeah, pee in a pool.
That's an interesting map.
My thanks to Justin McConnell, whose new movie Life Changer opens in theaters in Toronto, Ottawa, and Calgary this Friday, December 28th, before landing on VOD next Tuesday, January 1st. Thanks also to Ingrid Hamilton. She knows what she did. You can find Justin on Twitter at UnstableGround, all one word, and you can find Christmas Evil on Blu-ray and DVD from The Vinegar Syndrome in a special edition that includes all the extras from the Synapse release that Justin mentioned. It's also streaming on Shudder. And Justin was right, the film predated Silent Night, Deadly Night by 4 full years. Also, Billy was the killer in the first Silent Night, Deadly Night, and his brother Ricky took over in the second one. It's amazing. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you in 2019. Happy holidays, everybody. Don't get murdered.